Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, here with my two sidekicks. There is Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
Hello, gentlemen. We are coming to you a little late. We all had some stuff to do this weekend, so we're recording Monday night. Hopefully no one minds. I'm gonna say right now, we will be having a brief monologue by me on Captain America the Winter Soldier. We're also gonna be talking about Nymphomaniac, Volume 1 and 2, newest film written and directed by Lars von Trier. Guys, how long do you think we can go without sinking into some kind of really tortured innuendo?
How long can we last before climaxing here?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I was going to make a joke about arriving late. But I'm just going to call this. Guys, there's probably going to be a lot of really terrible innuendos at the beginning before we really dive into the movie. Because I think there's enough to talk about that we can hold back.
Yeah.
But just in case.
Avoid the messy stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Once we really get into the meat of it. Once we dive deep. God. And we've already started off at a low point. Anyway, let me remind everyone at home that you can rate us on iTunes. Don't rate us based on our innuendo. Please rate us based on our actual skill. And you can also leave us comments on the pages that these are posted at on thefilmstage.com. And you can always email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com if you would like to give us a bit of a lengthier thought. On that note, we always kind of make a point of bringing up any new reviews that we get. So let's do that, because we did get a new review, 5-star review. In case anyone's wondering, we are currently at a 4.5-star average, which I think is pretty damn good. But, you know, it can always be higher. So if some people want to go on there and give us some 5-star reviews, much appreciated. In that same vein, much appreciated to Sexy Sadie, which I'm assuming is a Beatles reference. Otherwise, this young lady is very confident.
What have they done?
What have they done? This will appeal to anyone with a healthy love of memes. The title of this review is Much Articulate, Very Interest, Such Analysis, Do Like. 5-star review. Somehow did not work WoW into there, but we'll give it a pass. She says, Doge meme aside, what a wonderful podcast. I'm not much of a movie watcher, but I do enjoy listening to this. Mostly because the host, Brian, I think, has a soothing voice. But also because now I can know a detailed interpretation of a movie without even watching it. Laziness at a whole new level. Hashtag YOLO. Hashtag can't stop me.
Great review.
Thank you, Sadie.
Thank you.
We will take it. We will take that review. So, yeah, if you agree with Sexy Sadie, leave us a note on iTunes and give us a rating and a comment, because we can't get enough. We are, I was going to say, whores for feedback. Really, I think Nymphomaniac's done a number on me. Anyway, before we get into Nymphomaniac, I do want to talk about the number one movie in America, possibly the world. It's making a lot of money, and it's actually getting really good reviews. That is Captain America the Winter Soldier. It is the newest Marvel film. It is the third film in which Captain America has appeared, first being, obviously, Captain America the First Avenger, then Marvel's The Avengers, and now this. And I have a lot of things to say about this film. Unfortunately, Nick and Danny, neither of you saw this, correct?
Correct. Yeah, Lars, 4 hours of Lars. I couldn't.
I needed this after 4 hours of Lars.
That's true.
Let's say that. This was a palate cleanser for me. So Captain America the Winter Soldier. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm not the biggest fan of the Marvel films, but that Captain America the First Avenger was my favorite among those films. So I had a lot invested in this movie. just on a very basic level. And also, it comes from two directors, Joe and Anthony Russo, who made their bones on the NBC comedy Community, which I can't stop talking about. And so I was interested to see how they treated my favorite character in the Marvel Universe. And guys, this movie absolutely nails it. 100% just blows away every other Marvel movie and sets a new standard for what I thought this fluffy, brainless franchise could be. I think that I made no real attempt to hide my kind of disdain for Iron Man 3 and Thor 2 for the way that they kind of just brush aside the earth-shattering climax of the Avengers and the paradigm-shifting nature of said climax. And this movie actually, this is a world in which aliens have come and attacked New York. It still doesn't really read as any kind of close to reality. People just still seem a little too blasé about it. But this movie comes the closest to actually creating a continuum of this reality that feels like it makes sense. Not only that, but it integrates those greater things such as S.H.I.E.L.D. and, you know, name-dropping certain other Marvel characters in a way that doesn't play so much as like a wink and a nod to the nerd culture, but more like an actual organic building of the Marvel Universe. These people are name-dropped the way that someone in a movie might name-drop George Washington. Not to a history buff, but just to kind of create context around things. So even if I didn't get every reference, I still appreciated simply the tone with which they were approaching the references. So that's pretty good on its own. Just getting that annoying clunk out of the way was great for me. What's even better is that this movie, unlike the weird treatment that Tony Stark gets in the films that bear his superhero analog signature, this movie creates a wonderful, emotional, psychologically grounded continuation of the character of Captain America. Steve Rogers in this, played by Chris Evans, who is one of my favorite young kind of action-oriented actors, especially after Sunshine, he is just great in this. I mean, we all know that I have a fondness for the Boy Scout character, the Indiana Jones, the Tintin. And this is it. Like, this is great. This is... What Superman ought to have been is what Captain America is. He perfectly holds up that kind of non-xenophobic, non-jingoistic patriotism. He fully imbibes the kind of rote, you know, rah-rah America, the exceptionalism of the country, and creates a more universal aspect to it. And not only that, but the movie's just fun. It's a friend of mine said this, so I'm going to crib what he said. Dan Gavazdin, shout out.
Oh, yeah.
He said that this is the best action movie he's seen since Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. And I agree. Nothing has done it better since then. This one does it. This one has some fantastic action scenes. It's paced to within an inch of its life. And it's not just big stuff. I mean, of course, if you've seen the trailers, you know that there's going to be some big explosions and huge set pieces, but there are simple fist fights in this movie that contain an amount of choreography and thought and small detail that is just astounding. No spoilers, obviously, because no one else saw this, but just the way that the Winter Soldier will find himself with one arm, you know, pinned, and then drop the knife and then grab it with his other hand and begin the attack again. Fast, quick, simple things like that. And they create such a nuanced sense of the scale of the action that it's really the type of movie that I almost immediately wanted to turn around and see again. It's got a lot of little pop culture references that are, again, not overdone. The story has a tone that is... I mean, a lot of other people have said it, and I gotta ring the same bell. It's very similar to the old paranoid political thrillers of the 70s. No guess then. No question why Robert Redford is in this.
Yeah, Redford. How was he?
He was good. He was good. He had a grounded role, but you know, when it came time for him to start some comic book stuff, I mean, he was in it. Everyone was committed. No one was winking. Anthony Mackie, who I have never not liked in a movie, continues his streak and creates a really, really great character here. Frank Grillo is amazing. Great physicality. You know, I mean, everyone in this movie, really. Even Emily Van Camp, who has a moment in it. Scarlett Johansson really comes to her own in this film. The interplay between her and Captain America is just great. I really can't say enough good things about this. I don't have a single issue with the movie itself. Obviously, all the post-credit sequences, who knows? I don't even count those as part of the film, so it doesn't really matter. But yeah, there's something about this film that really struck a chord with me, and it's just damn good. And I don't have to be depressed that it's getting good reviews and making a lot of money. Like, I'm really honestly excited about this film, and yeah, everyone should go see it. So that's my monologue, my gushing monologue about Captain America the Winter Soldier. I guess we can move on. Here's the thing, though, before we do that, I just want to say one thing. One of my huge problems with the Avengers was how every character, I think, except Iron Man, only had one film to get set up in. And they left a lot of their emotional plot threads dangling, which is something that really destroyed some of my enjoyment in that film. And every film since then has tried to pick those up again. And that's a problem. I understand, you know, you had to get it out quick or else you were going to lose that lightning in a bottle sense of it actually happening. But if they had given Captain America and Thor the two movies that they had with the emotional beats they had, I think I would have enjoyed it a lot more. They've done a really good job of, you know, picking up those lines again as though nothing happened. The problem is, they're doing it as though nothing happened. Again, world-shifting, paradigm-decimating things have happened. And after that, it seems kind of weird that you would go and, you know, try to talk to your old girlfriend. But, you know, this is the movies we've got, and if you can kind of get over that mental hurdle, and the mental hurdle of a 50-story skyscraper in downtown Washington, which is actually illegal, you can enjoy this. You can enjoy it. It's a fantastic movie, an orgasmically good movie, which will help us segue into our future review of Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac, Volume 1 and 2, a four-hour odyssey through the life of a self-diagnosed nymphomaniac, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg, as she's telling her story to Stellan Skarsgård. This movie's out now in limited release and on VOD, as well as, I would assume, iTunes and Amazon. So let's talk about it. This is our review of Nymphomaniac.
There's nothing to smile about.
All I wanted to say was that if you have wings, why not fly?
If I asked you to take my virginity, would that be a problem?
No, I don't see a problem.
You are to ask him if he wanted to have sex with me.
Yeah,
My name is Joe.
Hi, Joe.
And I'm a nymphomaniac.
Sex addict.
We say sex addict.
I know that. What?
Would it be all right if I show the children the whoring bed?
I've never met a bad human being.
Well, you have now.
So Nymphomaniac is Lars von Trier's follow-up to his last film, which was Melancholia. And in that movie, during the run-up to it, he said that there would be no more happy endings. Let's put that joke aside for now. And let's talk about Nymphomaniac and what we felt about it. We will be doing this in a traditional non-spoiler and then spoiler section. It's a four-hour movie. I really don't know how to qualify what is a spoiler, but I think we can use our best judgment. Needless to say that we will begin with our general thoughts, and then we'll dive down into the plot more in spoilers. So, gentlemen, Nymphomaniac, let's get into it. Nick Newman, what did you think?
Well, I wrote a review of the film for the film stage, so you just go read my review.
You just want to read the review to us right now?
Yeah, I mean, do you have any more to add to the A-? Like,
Sure. I watched Infomaniac like the rest of you. And, you know, maybe I should preface just by saying that I did indeed see it in two parts. I actually saw it separated by, I think there was a 16-day separation between my viewings, which created kind of an interesting experience. I'll get to that in a second, but I just want to say that I am really quite fond of the movie, which is not surprising insofar as considering my anticipation for the film and sort of how I've been thinking that it looked like sort of a lot of fun and maybe exactly the kind of film I want Lars von Trier to make, but also a little surprising when I consider that I'm not actually the biggest von Trier fan. I generally like his work, but for me, his past couple of films have, I guess maybe his past like three films been a bit off. Yeah, there was Melancholia, which I wasn't so keen on, and Antichrist, which I think is very problematic, and there's also The Boss of It All. I don't know, has anybody here seen that?
No.
That's, I've actually heard some interesting stuff about it, but
yeah. It's basically well, it's okay. It's an office comedy that's sort of directed with this machine. It's kind of hard to explain. You have to see it for yourself. But anyway, I'm not exactly sure what it is about Infomaniac that strikes me as maybe his best film. No, certainly his best film since – at least his best film since Dogville. I'm thinking maybe his best since Breaking the Waves, which is all the way back in 1995. For me, it's kind of this sort of laser focus that he has here, where he's making a four-hour film about this all-consuming disease, and in doing so, he's filling it with all sorts of things that you would not really relate to sex. These digressions which occur between Charlotte Gainsbourg's Joe and Stellan Skarsgård's Seligman in the present day, or something approximating the present day. Even the country that it takes place in is unclear.
Yeah, I was about to say, the movie takes place out of time and space.
Right. And I found myself just increasingly pulled in by these conversation aspects of the film. And when you actually got to the sex, that was usually actually quite funny. And although it is about a disease, and I guess for me, the film is a really terrific comedy that is littered with tragic elements. And I think it uses the tragic elements both sparingly and by that token, very effectively, the way it kind of lunges out and almost stabs you in a way. And I think that maybe where von Trier can kind of get away with sort of his very on the nose screenwriting is that this is also a film about people who relate everything to something else. This is a film about people who have no real conception of the way the world works, and they have no real conception of the ways things actually function, except for a specific obsession. In the case of Joe, the central character, it is sex. In the case of Seligman, it is literature and just various forms of knowledge that you can obtain. And I found the experience of it just very stimulating. I don't know if it really goes much past what is actually presented, but I'm not sure if it needs to either. For me, watching the movie was like listening in on a very well-prepared lecture, almost. But the movie does not lecture you either. And also, I want to say that I think that von Trier is, if nothing else, is an excellent caster. Because I may
hit... Fishing metaphor?
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah.
As far as Charlotte Gainsbourg goes, that choice is not very surprising because they've had two successful collaborations thus far. And same with Stellan Skarsgård. But he found this young British model named Stacey Martin, who's absolutely terrific in the film. She's the star of Volume 1, really.
Yeah, she takes up by far more screen time than Charlotte Gainsbourg.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Even though her IMDb profile picture is just the poster for this film.
Right,
she appears to be having an orgasm.
Well, the thing is, this is actually her first, on-screen acting role.
They
it's very difficult
get her
to believe.
A headshot.
And it's very difficult to believe because
yeah,
I think she just inhabits the character with such fluidity. And there's something even like even Shia LaBeouf as this really prick, shitheaded, sort of wannabe bureaucrat. And a lot of people, I've heard a lot of people say that he's, you know, astoundingly bad in the film, but I actually quite appreciated his performance because I think he, maybe without even completely realizing it, fits this role very well.
Oh, yeah.
He's completely believable as this sort of character. And I think Von Trier is certainly aware of it. How much LaBeouf is, I kind of wonder.
I think that Lars von Trier is a director who is not above casting someone he thinks will be great and then not telling him why he thinks they will be great. So the whole thing could just be a giant joke on Shia LaBeouf.
It could be.
And it works. I mean, it definitely works in the way you're talking about.
And then there's Uma Thurman, who I think has... Honestly, I think it is one of the greatest one-scene turns in any film ever.
She is astounding in this film.
And it's funny because I don't know if I've seen Uma Thurman in a film since Kill Bill Volume 2. I think it's actually been that long.
I'm sure she has been in some, but yeah, I don't know what I've seen that she could possibly have been in.
And it's funny because I really love the performance of hers I've seen, and I realized how much I missed her watching this as this. I won't even really say what it is. If you've seen the clip that's been online since like July, you have some idea. But I watched Volume 1 with a decent sized group of people, and that's one of the best viewing experiences I think I'll have this year, is that scene with a group of people having absolutely no idea how to react. And although they have no idea to react, that is von Trier having complete control over his audience.
Yeah.
That scene is
amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of the centerpiece of the entire four-hour experience in a lot of ways. And but even then, there's this really wonderful segment, the Little Organ School, which uses sexual imagery as something both very kind of touching and very sweet, and also something really kind of alien and bizarre. It's another kind of encapsulation that takes place in this movie. For me, it is maybe. I'm trying to figure out if it's a film of incredible moments that builds to a very strong result, or if it is a completely cohesive whole. But I'm not sure if I care that much because I just happen to like it so much as is. And I just want to say one last thing before I hand it off. Watching this in two parts was a fascinating experience because I know that it was not originally intended to play this way. So.
Right.
It is for commercial purposes, but I actually found the experience of watching it with that more than 2 week gap really fascinating because the movie deals very heavily in not just the workings of memory, but sort of the idea of recombining and recontextualizing and re-understanding your own memory and kind of bringing things back and sort of looking at them in a new light. And watching the second half was almost like, you know, it was almost like leaving a room for a minute after a really long argument and kind of jumping right back in. Or it was almost like awaking from a strange dream and, you know, finding yourself in a worse state almost. So the experience of watching in two parts I actually liked, which is kind of weird. But there's one moment in particular that I think I found more powerful because of the split, which feels very strange. But I look forward to seeing the full 5.5-hour cut when it's released, probably by the end of this year, I would assume, at least on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll be there. But for now, I'm really quite fond of it. I would say it's my favorite movie of 2014 so far. I mean, I haven't actually seen that much from 2014, but there you have it.
All right. Danny King, let's get into your thoughts.
Wow.
How are you going to follow that up?
Yeah, I don't know. Well done. I feel like I should mention that I saw Uma Thurman in Playing for Keeps, which is sort of a strange fact.
Okay.
Like that was the last thing I saw her in, which was probably not as good as her performance in Nymphomaniac. I also wanted to briefly mention one other film that I watched maybe a month ago now. And it was streaming on Mubi for sort of Nymphomaniac anticipation reasons. It's a 1973 film called Anita, Swedish Nymphette. And the opening title card is something like, this is the story of a 17-year-old nymphomaniac or something like that. And what's funny about it is that the person she ends up confiding to and kind of spending a lot of time with is Stellan Skarsgård. And so at this point in his life, he was probably 20 or 21 when he when he acted in that film, and he looks really awkward in the film, sort of like he had a really kind of significant growth spurt before like growing into his body in a way. So he just looks quite awkward, but he's sort of playing that same role of like counselor and therapist in a way. So if you did enjoy him in Nymphomaniac, maybe try to find that film somewhere. But yeah, as for Nymphomaniac itself, I was pretty conflicted on the film, and I'm still working through it. But I think I'm like, right now I'm coming down on the negative side of things, just because I found the whole experience incredibly incohesive, and sort of like it almost gave me whiplash. And after a while, that turned from like a good whiplash to sort of like an annoying kind of like I just wanted the movie to end. And actually, in terms of talking about like these digressions that Skarsgård makes, Davy Jenkins wrote about this film on Letterboxd, and he said that at its worst, these digressions resemble like Family Guy. And I sort of felt that.
Oh my
that,
God, I hadn't made that connection.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a brilliant comparison that he made. And like, so just the fact that I agree with that probably shows maybe how annoyed I was with this film by the end of it. And that was sort of compounded by the fact that the ending is, which we can talk about, but I found the ending pretty just disgusting and really off-putting. But as for the main section of the movie, I feel like Von Trier sort of just has himself in a trap with this project, because he, you know, the movie's called Nymphomaniac, 2 volumes, 4 hours, with a 5.5 hour cut in the wait. But all of his kind of interests and all of his energy in the movie seems to be in these sort of small scenes that don't necessarily feel like they belong in this 4 hour treatise on Nymphomaniac. And so when I try to think of the film as a comedy that's enjoyable and that's sort of surprising from a director like Von Trier, I don't find the comedy that inventive, because it's sort of like, okay, we have this Nymphomaniac character. Let's have her hit on a bunch of men on a train or scene like that. I just don't find it kind of original in the way that something like The Wolf of Wall Street is sort of really surprising comedy coming from Martin Scorsese. I find this sort of like, if you told me that Von Trier made a comedy about Nymphomania, I would just picture it, and it's not too surprising. And then also in terms of the framing device, I find it a little problematic that this whole movie is kind of presented as Charlotte Gainsbourg and Stellan Skarsgård just sort of hanging out and like talking to each other, because it kind of, for me, like ruins any potential dramatic stakes there are in the movie. So when her flashback episodes, as they ostensibly are supposed to get more and more serious, just there was never any momentum built up for me, because it keeps cutting away from them to this scene where the two of them are just sort of sitting in this room drinking tea, and it doesn't seem comparable to the drama that we're meant to be feeling. So just overall, I had a lot of trouble kind of reconciling the various facets of this film, but I'm definitely, you know, not anti Von Trier or anything, and I would be curious to see it again, I guess, but I was a little disappointed by it.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to trend closer to Danny on this one. So I've enjoyed Lars von Trier's latest streak. I really liked Antichrist. I flat out 100% fucking loved Melancholia. When I heard that he was making a film called Nymphomaniac, and that it was originally like 5 hours, and then they cut it to like 4, and then cut it in half, and I just saw in my head, you know, something like the nihilism of Melancholia, but also the intense humanism. It's a movie that believes in people and kind of hates systems. And so I saw in my head a movie like that called Nymphomaniac, and I was excited. Lars von Trier, no more happy endings provocateur, bringing us something that a lot of people wouldn't have the balls to. And the movie is fine. I didn't struggle through any of it. I watched it over the course of two nights on VOD. And I think that if I had sat down and seen it in a four-hour run, I would have been fine with it. Maybe physically uncomfortable from having to sit still for that long. But I would have been fine. The problem comes for me in the way that I said earlier that Lars von Trier wouldn't be above playing a joke on Shia LaBeouf by getting him and directing him, like, you're this important guy, you have so much of this, like, do that, and then just laughing hilariously as LaBeouf's posturing plays through as Jerome's posturing. And here I feel kind of like he's played another joke on the audience. Because you hear, mm-hmm. Lars von Trier, Nymphomaniac, you picture something, and then he spends the entire movie kind of spitting on that idea you have. It's definitely a comedy, which is its first, like, the way it first shook me out of my moorings was when I realized it was a comedy. The movie quotes von Trier, comments upon von Trier, and really kind of stacks up at the end of the day as something like a defense and a takedown and a little bit of him saying, I'm not so far up my own ass, I don't see what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing. This is what I'm doing.
Being anti-Zionist doesn't make you anti-Semitic.
Right. I mean, I can get behind that. I mean, we just talked about the Grand Budapest Hotel, which was the same thing, but for Wes Anderson. He made a defense of his stylistic choices. I loved the Grand Budapest Hotel, but that's because the story it told was still a serious story that didn't take itself and get subsumed by its own desire to validate its author, which I feel like this one does. There are moments which I love. There are things like the thing with Mrs. H, who's played by Uma Thurman. A staggering, just insane bit of filmmaking and acting from everyone involved. Never has silence spoken so loudly as every time the camera cuts to Stacey Martin as Joe. And even later on, when she's using her nymphomania as a kind of profession, not in the way you would expect. I mean, there were scenes in there that I loved, and we can talk about those more in spoilers. I even loved some of the stuff with Christian Slater talking about the souls of trees. Let's talk about Christian Slater being in this movie as her father. A banana's choice, but again, I just had to sit there and say, von Trier, you mad bastard, you genius, like, this is working for me. But I guess there's a distance to it, and a lack of real emotional and psychological investment in the characters that keeps me on the outside. It's fine if you want to use this as a way to draw people in, either through prurient interest or a kind of interest in seeing what a renegade filmmaker will do with such a provocative topic, only to show them something else with the sheen of this provocative topic on top of it. And maybe it's my fault for allowing my interest and my anticipation to get the best of me, but I just can't really get behind the film, which is, again, it's nothing about the way it's made. Like I said, 4 hours flew by. I had no problem with it. But especially towards the ending, especially the ending, it lost me and it couldn't get me back. And I can't imagine wanting to revisit the whole thing again, even though I would definitely watch certain chapters of it again. Much as you might own an album by an artist that you thought you liked, and the album is a disappointment, but there are certain songs I would love to go back and listen to, you know, track 2 or track 7, but I don't feel a need to see the entire thing in its entirety. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, like Danny said, it just doesn't cohere enough for me, especially, again, in the way that it ends, which we'll get into. So those are my thoughts on Nymphomaniac. I would say anyone who's interested in von Trier, and everyone should be interested in von Trier, I believe, should check it out, because it's obviously an uncompromising film. It's obviously what he meant to do, and you can feel his hand on it at all times. And so it is interesting to see him do that. But just be aware, this isn't melancholia on a human scale. This is something else. Something not quite as moving and not quite as affecting.
Well, I found it much more moving and affecting than melancholia, personally.
Is there a reason for that? Is it a non-spoiler reason, I suppose?
I suppose melancholia, not to get too much into that film, but I found for me, that was actually an example of just von Trier's imbalance, where I found the first half quite engaging and intriguing, and then the second I kind of tapered off a bit. But I also haven't seen the movie in... since November of 2011, so it's been a little bit. but my, melancholy is fine. I don't really think much of it. For me, we talk about the ending of the film, for instance. I mean, that I actually found really upsetting, very, very upsetting, and kind of haunting, too.
We'll talk about it. That'll be where we start off in the spoiler section.
And for me, it's not an intrusive element on the film's fabric. For me, it's actually an example of just kind of crystallizing what has come before and crystallizing what points he's trying to make and kind of how... For me, it's kind of how these things which seem incohesive actually do cohere, and they cohere in a very specific way and in a way that is quite germane to the central conflicts of the movie itself. And I guess, you talk about sort of the sense of choppiness in it. I mean, I don't know. I guess I was just so engaged by the back and forth between Joe and Seligman. And I was also, relatively wrapped up in this story of a young nymphomaniac that I kind of young into eventually middle-aged, that I found myself, I was not really bothered by that. I would say that certain sections are certainly more interesting than others. I didn't really find the stuff with Jamie Bell's character to be that fascinating, just because to me that's kind of, if you've seen the trailer, then it's not a spoiler to say that's like an S&M angle sort of, and I just don't really find that very interesting. Right. But at the same time, it's, even if that's a chapter that I could not necessarily do without, if that's a chapter which I don't really respond to as much, it kind of brings the movie further into its own. It kind of brings the movie further into focus for me. It brings the trajectory further into focus. And that's why I said before, I'm trying to figure out if this is a movie of great parts that coheres into something that I'm really quite appreciative of, or if it's just a really strong whole. I do ultimately probably think it's a really strong whole. And, is that a pun for a little bit of nymphomaniac? also the thing is that I guess part of it is that, although, yeah, it is funny, I think that von Trier kind of hurts himself as an artist and as a public figure, because he definitely enjoys sort of being the bad boy of world cinema, but he's also someone who has struggled with very severe depression and who clearly has a lot of troubled thoughts about humanity. And I think that sort of dealing through it with comedy is kind of a natural thing in a lot of ways. And I think that's what the comedy of the film is. I don't think it's, it's not funny in the way that I find, like The Nutty Professor funny. It's funny in the way that I would find, in like the way that I would find a really strange obituary funny, or someone dies by, like attempting to blow themselves, basically. Like that to me is the kind of humor this movie is going for. And I mean, it's not for everybody, certainly, but I guess maybe my own sense of humor and in some ways my own outlook on life, outlook on humanity, maybe coheres with von Trier's in ways that I'm not even comfortable admitting.
With melancholia, like, I got what he was saying. Like, that's what made it so powerful for me. And here, I don't feel like he never digs in. It's all surface.
For me, again, if it's surface, it's because it's the kind of people that we're dealing with here. And
I don't know if that's true.
I think it is, because I think that it's...
But he crafted those people. Like, you can make a shallow person have depth that they refuse to plumb.
Well, I think... No. I think that the characters have depth. I think they are just shallow-minded. And I think there's a very distinct, very important difference there between having depth and being shallow-minded. And I also, again, for me, it's all about the movie's last 2 minutes, which I found really, really upsetting and really crushing.
Right.
And again, because it kind of got into things that I don't really want to admit that I sometimes think about. It really got me to sort of think about certain parts of relationships I have with people. And,
well,
you know, I mean,
a stinger for the spoiler section.
and few films recently have done that in that way.
Okay.
I mean, I can't remember the last film that filled me with such dread with just the shot of a doorway. And, you know, I mean, I think that Von Trier is a formalist. I think his formal language is at times a bit tired and maybe not exactly my speed, but something like that, just the power he can extract from just that image, to me just kind of says a lot. And it's about building to it. So.
All right. Well, now that you've mounted your valiant defense and we've been dancing around the way that the movie ends, any final thoughts before we get into spoilers?
Just because Nick brought up like the formalism a little bit, I just had some brief thoughts on the style. It's not really related to narrative.
Okay.
Because I found myself a little bit disappointed by what he was doing as a director. And I think part of that is because there's so much focus on making a lot of the content in this movie very extreme that I don't think he's necessarily doing as much legwork as a director that he did in something like Antichrist for me, which, like, you know, Nick mentioned the shot of the door and filling him with dread. And I thought like Antichrist was that for the whole movie, that sensation just prolonged for like 90 minutes or 100 minutes or however long that movie was.
Right.
Whereas I don't feel like Nymphomaniac really had an atmosphere to it. And part of it is maybe because the story is framed as just these two people hanging out, so it just feels so relaxed in this strange way. But then I think of all like the sex scenes in the movie, and I don't remember like one image from a sex scene that felt distinguishable from any other one. It just seems like a bunch of...
I can think of at least two.
I mean, I'm but see, this is like the thing, if you're just talking about content, but I'm thinking about the way he's filming it.
Yeah.
And like, it's just one 4-hour blur that I can't really distinguish formally. And that was kind of disappointing because he's doing a lot of other really insane things with cutting to an image of fly fishing or whatever. That stuff's like,
right, which
weird enough to be.
All of that was hilarious to me.
Yeah,
I mean, this woman is like talking about how she's seducing people on a train, and Stellan Skarsgård as Seligman can't help but say, "Oh, you know, this is what you were doing. This is the fucking symbolism." I mean, his apartment is literally littered with things that she is using to title her story as she goes on. And it plays almost like a riff on The Usual Suspects.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. It's almost like he seems to think that in those sex scenes, the very act itself is enough.
I would defend it by saying that if it seems indistinguishable, I think it's also because movie...
To her, it's probably...
Right, and I think the movie treats the sex as a very... often kind of a bland thing. The only moments that are significant are when she loses her virginity, and also the segment with the guy, I think his name is like F or something, and he's the one who, it's in the chapter of the Little Organ School,
right.
Which is one of the only moments of actual intimacy in the entire movie, and I found something kind of... Honestly, I found something kind of touching about the image of him performing cunnilingus on her. I know that sounds kind of strange, but for me there was something kind of touching about it because it was...
Well, that's probably the most intimate act that she's ever engaged
in. Yeah, and you kind of... I don't know, I felt a strange sense of sympathy for the character in that moment just because you have to wonder if she's ever really had many experiences like that. And
right.
And that, again, we keep coming back to this. But again, it's about building to that. It's about arriving at that through so many smaller moments.
Well, it's weird that you say you had sympathy for her because she doesn't get many moments like that. She doesn't want them.
I mean, it's not about wanting them. It's about seeing the satisfaction that she receives from it.
Right.
She doesn't seem
unsatisfied.
No. It's not that she's unsatisfied. It's that to me it seems like something that, you know, it seems like an unpleasant thing, just personally speaking, to have this sort of thing controlling you. No matter how much she loves her cunts, and no matter how much she loves her filthy, dirty lust, still.
Quoting the movie, P.S.
Yes.
That's not just Nick letting loose. I mean, I guess. I don't know. We'll get into it in spoilers. So let's move into that. If you haven't seen Nymphomaniac, like I said, it's in limited release, and it is on VOD, so you can check it out there. So this is spoilers for Nymphomaniac. I'll begin just by saying, I mean, an obvious parallel, and even IMDb's page for this is drawing it, is to Shame. These are two movies that kind of, you know, say, hey, we're going to talk about sex addiction in a serious way. Shame, I believe, does a much better job. And I think that's one of the things that I was upset about, is that in Shame you see the spiral that this man goes through. And it's only snapshots, and you don't ever really learn his history. But you can see the same kind of things that are going on. In the movie, Nymphomaniac, Jo embraces it. She makes no excuses for it. It's a piece of her, and she loves it. In Shame, obviously, he's ashamed of it, so it tortures him and torments him, and there's really not much he can do about it. I was looking forward to seeing a movie that was not only from a female perspective, but that was kind of joyful and celebratory. Sex is so often used in a kind of shameful way in films. And I don't think that Shame does that because it thinks that sex is shameful. I think it's because society says that it's shameful, and that's part of the push-pull of that picture. And in this, Jo has broken out of it, and it's great. But there's just some strange things that happen. At the end of the first movie, she loses all sensation, and she loses her orgasm, as she says. And then that's what drives her to have a very awkward, almost threesome. So that's what drives her to go see Kay, who is Jamie Bell's character. He runs an underground dungeon. There's no intercourse. There's nothing. It's just him abusing women, and they like it, which is great. Again, sexuality is a weird beast, and some people enjoy that, and I liked that. I liked the unflinching, unjudgmental eye. But again, Von Trier throws this moment in where he literally quotes Antichrist down to the music.
Oh, God.
And we're in spoilers now, so I can say it. Jo has the world's shittiest babysitter, the only babysitter in the whole city, apparently. And she goes to see her dom and leaves the baby alone. And then the baby gets out of his room and goes towards the snowy porch. Because he sees the lights of the plow and the music and the almost slow-mo. It's not as slow as Antichrist starts, as you're just thinking, oh great, this kid is going to fall out of the goddamn window. He does not. Shia LaBeouf saves him. But I mean, what is the purpose? I mean, she keeps losing things because of this, but she doesn't care. And at the end, she's like, you know what? I finally lost enough. I guess I'm going to change. I'm going to live my life without sex. This thing that gives me great joy sometimes, depending on the situation, I guess. And that's because Jerome and her lesbian sidekick that she gets when she becomes a gangster who sexually tortures people to extort money from them beat the shit out of her, fuck in front of her, and then urinate on her. I mean, what are we to draw from this? What is the purpose? What is it saying? Like, what is it doing to her? She's like she's finally had the shackles of a patriarchal sex shaming society thrown off, but now they're beaten back onto her again.
Well, primarily, I'm really impressed that he got Mean Streets era Robert De Niro to play the older Jerome. But
I was.
I don't know if anybody else noticed that.
Did you think it looked like him?
I thought it looked exactly like him, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It was really strange.
I thought he looked like oh God, what's his name? Ah, crap. Mark Strong. It looked like Mark Strong got like put into a blender for a second.
Okay. For me, it's kind of it all comes down to 3 + 5,
right.
And that there's something I think kind of wonderfully ironic about this woman's life only really coming down to a few people and a connection back to this thing which is seemingly completely unrelated, and it's the way that kind of for me it's sort of accumulating misery and it's accumulating sort of the. Sort of the seemingly random but perhaps fate-driven nature of the universe, and something that I think is very von Trierian in a way, that idea, this strange, mysterious order of the universe, and how, you know, as the final line of the movie says, she has fucked thousands of men, but it always comes back to that one. And I think there's the question of if this is even exactly what's happened, because as Seligman says to her, you know, there are far too many coincidences in her with her relationship to Jerome. But as she replies, she's the one telling the story, so we have to listen. Which is not to say, you know, therefore it is a completely justifiable thing. Just that, for one thing, I think it is relatively germane to what is being established, the idea of an unreliable narrator telling their own story, but also furthermore, deeper, more interestingly, more pertinently, that it's just, you know, it comes down to this much because ultimately nymphomania for her, I think for her is kind of a doorway, but because she is sort of a stubborn, obstinate person, where she's going is kind of dictated by these very specific desires. These very specific desires inside of a very large desire, or rather, a desire that is itself very large, that is all-consuming, again, as I've said before. I like that it kind of came down to no more than these two people who she has had sex with, and these two people who she has felt, the only two people who she's really felt a romantic attachment to, except for, again, maybe F., as I refer to him, or as the film refers to him. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I found it justifiable, and I didn't really mind it. But, yeah, that's sort of my way of viewing it.
All right, Danny, any thoughts?
Yeah, boy. I mean, yeah, in terms of, like, some of this stuff in the second half, I mean, from a big picture perspective, like Brian, when you were recapping the story, it just sort of confirmed my thoughts of like how incoherent this movie is, because you were just sort of stating events like one after the other, like, okay, so she's with Kay for 20 minutes, then she's working with a gangster and forging a mother-daughter relationship and then a lesbian relationship. And it's just like, what the hell is going on? But in the middle of that, I found some interesting sort of details, like her scene where she is working as sort of like the extortionist or whatever, and she has this scene with like a pedophile guy. I thought that was a pretty provocative scene because it seemed like one of the few that actually had like a coherent idea.
Yeah, had like an ethos to it.
Yeah, so like I was shaken by that. And then the stuff with Kay, you know, like at the end of the day, like I'm not going to be like, yeah, those scenes were like fantastic, like great stuff. But like, there is just something about, because I'm also like you guys, a fan of his stunt casting. So just seeing Jamie Bell, like walk around this room, trying to like pass himself off as this convincing, like S&M mastermind, I found pretty funny. But then, like, another scene where, like, she is with, like, those two African men, I found that, like, the most common denominator brand of comedy, because she, like, she walks home with the two of them, they can't communicate, And like the potential for uncomfortable comedy in that scene is like almost unimaginable, especially with a director like Von Trier. Mm-hmm. But the scene is just like one note over and over again of her sitting there and Von Trier like filming their dicks. And it's like the same, it's the same joke for like 2 or 3 minutes. And I'm like, you could have pushed this scene so much further. And the one area he does decide to push that scene is in the conversation where they're talking about the meaning of, you know, these racial terms. But like, I would have preferred to see that tension in action while we were seeing that. And then in terms of the ending, like, I didn't like that ending. I agree with Nick, yeah, though, that shot at the door was like, that freaked me out, but like,
it freaked me out, but it was because I knew he was going to betray a character.
Yeah, because that wasn't him.
It wasn't him. It's like he. Yeah, that it's like wasn't a whole him. Different. So, all right, we should tell people what happened, or just context it, I guess. So Seligman listens to this whole thing, doesn't become sexually aroused at all, and Joe at some point points this out to him, and he says he's asexual. He's a virgin. He's never been with anyone. He's like masturbated twice and didn't see a point in it. So it's the perfect foil for her to tell this to. He's a man without sexuality. She is a woman ruled by sexuality. They should solve crimes together. I mean, it just makes sense. And then in the end, after she's done and she says, you know what, I'm gonna abstain for the rest of my life. I'm going to not let this thing rule me. She's asserting control where she needed no control before. And then he tells her goodnight, tucks her in, leaves the room, and then comes back in without pants on, kneels on the bed next to her, begins fondling himself, and then she fucking shoots him. And then leaves. And his one thing after she's taken the gun out, he's like, what, you've been with thousands of men? Bang. Sound of rustling clothes. I mean, this is all done in darkness, too. I should say that as soon as she goes for the gun, it cuts to black. And then it's like a radio show. But I mean, what is that? Where is that coming from?
Yeah, and that's actually, you know, you were talking about how you were enjoying maybe how he was manipulating like Shia LaBeouf a little bit. But at that point, I felt awful for Skarsgård, who did all of this hard work to create such a sincere character. And like watching that final scene is so tough because you're like, this is not the character that he spent 4 hours building.
It's like in a movie when an alien parasite takes over a mild-mannered guy and he's about to eat a baby and everyone's standing around like, this isn't you, Jimmy. Jimmy, this isn't you. Remember who you are, Jimmy. And then Jimmy, like the parasitic green light in his eyes goes out and he looks around and starts crying. And he's like, oh my God, what did I almost do? Except in this, Jimmy's about to take a bite out of the baby and someone shoots him in the face. Like, I don't... Nick, as the defender of this film, what can you tell me about this scene that might change my reading of it?
It's hard. I don't know how to say this without making it very uncomfortably personal.
Okay.
Okay. So I was very, again, like you guys, I was very upset by this final scene. More upset than I've been by anything in most movies as of late. But not exactly for the same reason you guys were. I found it unfortunately kind of logical. What? In a way. Let me just.
Okay.
So. Trying to think, how do I put this exactly? What I said earlier was that it kind of got me thinking about male-female relations in a way that's kind of been on my mind as of late for various reasons that we don't need to go into and which our listeners don't have a right to hear, frankly. but it also had me thinking about my relationships with certain people and. And it is dark, yeah. Hi, everyone. And I kind of... what would I say here that can... How do I say this without saying too much? For me, it was kind of... It was sort of the idea that you know, if it got me thinking about my relationships I have with certain people, I was also kind of wondering. Here's what I'll say. A lot of the movie is about reflections, and a lot of the movie, it's about Lars von Trier reflecting himself inside the two central characters. And it is about how those two sides of him cannot be reconciled, and how if they do meet, the meaning of them can only be something as decisive and something as unfortunate as a killing, as a murder. And I mean, I think that's reflected rather clearly in something such as a chapter which is titled The Mirror, which in addition to being one of several Tarkovsky references throughout the film, it's about being afraid to look at yourself. It's about being afraid to consider what part of yourself is buried there, the kind of part that you can recognize, the kind of part that you might think about right before you fall asleep. And then when you wake up, it's gone, but it's still there. It's something like, in some ways it's Lars von Trier, I think, patting himself on the back too, where this woman who is sort of representative of him, who's telling a story that he himself has conceived, has told the story so well, has told the story with such conviction, and has detailed it so thoroughly that it can turn someone like Seligman into a curious party, where he's heard so much about sex, and it's relating so much to his own interest that he thinks to himself, well, this is probably the only person he's had a really friendly conversation with, a really in-depth conversation with, in probably years, maybe decades.
And you think that that's enough for him to be like, oh, she was just beaten and humiliated, and I literally walked her to this thing where she's saying no more, and oh, well, I'll try to squeeze one in.
Again, it's about, for me, my reaction to it, my finding it a legitimate conclusion is about, it's about thinking about my own recent experiences, and it's thinking about my own, you know, recent interactions with certain people and the way that it, you know, the questions I've had about my relationships with them and what exactly certain gestures mean. And, I saw it kind of reflected there, and it was very troubling. I didn't like the way that, it's a movie that I didn't like the way this movie made me feel, which is kind of a classic von Trier thing, right. But it wasn't really in the expected way either. It's not that I didn't like the way it made me feel, in part because I could absolutely sense that this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So you guys say it was a surprise, but for me it was...
It wasn't a surprise. That was the problem.
Yeah,
I knew
it's
he
weird.
Was going to screw that character over.
Yeah. Well, it's not about screwing the character over. It's about what he is going to do.
But he wouldn't do that. The character wasn't created in a way that action made any sense.
No, but I think it is, because I was sensing that from the very beginning that this was going to happen.
But I only sense
about
that because it's von Trier and he can make people do whatever he wants.
Okay, that's your reaction. I sensed it because I saw something in there from myself, frankly.
Okay.
And it was something that I didn't like. It's something that I appreciate. It's just not something I was comfortable with. And that the movie got me to have that reaction, I see as a sign of great success. And that it's had me kind of thinking about various things outside the film. I'm almost making it sound like I'm like a rapist or something. I don't want to give that impression. It's not that. It's just
right.
it's several things. Okay. None of which involve rape. Or pulling my penis out in front of people. Let's just make that clear. even if I'm trying to be a little vague, it's just, okay, it doesn't involve anything like that. I mean, for me, it's kind of about identifying with, I feel like I really kind of identified with von Trier's own trajectory from an early point. I feel like I grooved into it early, and I was kind of waiting for it to happen. And then when it finally did happen, that made it all the worse. And if you didn't have that reaction yourself, there's really nothing I can say, but I know I felt, I know that it was building this way for me, and that it actually, and then it finally reached it. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's end on that note. We've talked this movie to death. Nymphomaniac. It's out now. Feel free to go for it if you please. Let's get into the new releases for this week on DVD and Blu-ray. So coming out, Blu-ray and DVD. The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug.
Smaug.
We also have Grudge Match with De Niro and Stallone. August Osage County. Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones. Nurse 3D. Touch of Sin.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
And that looks like all the new releases worth mentioning.
I don't see a Touch of Sin. Oh, there it is. Sorry. Okay. Wow. I didn't realize that was. It should be more. Okay.
Anyway, so.
Did you mention A Field in England?
Oh, A Field in England. And A Field in England.
By Ben Wheatley.
Yeah. So, any of these striking your fancy, guys?
I have not seen The Desolation of Smaug, although I will eventually. I am curious about it because I, you know, I am a fan of Lord of the Rings. I did not think the first Hobbit film was very good, but right. I've heard. I know that Jordan, who was really kind of irritated by
yeah.
An Unexpected Journey, said that he found this more in the spirit of the original trilogy. As someone who likes the original trilogy, I will see it. I actually kind of intended to when I was on like my winter break, but then I just didn't. also, Touch of Sin is great. That was on my top 10 of last year.
Yeah, I want to see that. So that's what I'll be pushing for.
Cool. In sort of re-releases, Robert Zemeckis' Used Cars, which is a really, really funny film starring Kurt Russell.
Cool. Okay.
Which I think I saw that when I was like 9 years old. but I'm sure it'll hold up. Again, in bad timing, Broadway Danny Rose by Woody Allen. Someone should really push this releases back like 6 months, maybe.
It's such a sweet movie, like in a different...
Yeah. Billy Wilder's Sabrina, which is a very good film, actually would make a very good double feature with one of his best films, The Apartment. Two very sweet, uplifting movies about failed suicide attempts. And Wild at Heart, which is one of my least favorite Dave Lynch films, but... Maybe warrants a revisit. I mean, it warrants a revisit because it's Lynch. I'll even revisit Dune at some point, maybe. That's one of my least favorite films of his, but we actually have a piece on that film by past guest Ethan Vespi, which should be up by the time this podcast airs.
For the Blu-ray release?
Yes. So Wild at Hearts, that's something I'll be focusing on. But otherwise, yeah, I don't really have many thoughts.
After you just gave 5 minutes of thoughts.
Yes.
Danny King, any anything to add?
Yeah, well, Touch of Sin was also on my top 10. I'm also not a big Wild at Heart fan, but looking forward to reading Ethan's piece. And Grudge Match, I might get around to seeing sometime soon. Like, that cover is bringing the anticipation back.
All right. Well, let's talk about what's coming into theaters then. We've got Rio 2, the sequel to Rio, obviously. Draft Day, the newest film by Connie director Ivan Reitman, starring Kevin Costner. We also have Oculus, a horror film about a mirror. Only Lovers Left Alive is hitting limited release by Jim Jarmusch. Joe, hitting limited release, that is by David Gordon Green. Hate Ship, Love Ship, which I will have a review of up on the film stage, that is by Liza Johnson, starring Kristen Wiig. And Guy Pearce. There's a couple of other things that are coming out, but let's keep it to just that. So, guys, any of these getting you going? Anything that you're looking for?
Only Lovers, which I'm going to be, which I think I'll be seeing this weekend. Actually, as sort of a late birthday trip. I'm very, very, really, really excited because I love Jarmusch, and you know, I only got into his films kind of recently, but. It is. I only got into films within the last 2 years, but this is like 5 years since The Limits of Control, which is really strange. And yeah, no, I mean, you know, vampire rock star film by him, sure, I'm up for it immediately. So yes, I've heard it's great.
All right,
I'm expecting it.
Danny King.
Yeah, definitely. Also looking forward to Only Lovers Left Alive. Pretty curious about Joe too. I do like David Gordon Green, at least like his earlier stuff, but also just to see Nicolas Cage in a role like that. His character's name is Joe Ransom, which seems at odds with
which
this
is hilarious,
whole like
he just had a movie out called Ransom, didn't he? I don't think he did.
I think he might have, and he's not even aware.
The fact that it's so close to like what a title probably was is a problem, but. But I like Cage, so like I'll
yeah.
It was stolen. I'm sorry, it was
stolen.
It's stolen to be held for ransom, probably. okay, yeah. I'm also looking forward to both of those films, so I'll just throw my hat in there. Next week, most likely we'll be talking about Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson. Should be interesting. I liked her in The Avengers, I liked her in Her. I liked her in pretty much almost everything that she's been doing lately, so can't wait to see the streak continue. Let's give you some random recommendations of stuff that we've seen on our own this week, and then we can get out of here. So, Danny King.
Yeah, the other night for a teacher actually recommended this for an assignment. I watched Charade, which is Stanley Donen's 1963 like caper romance comedy, kind of like his Hitchcock movie. And I watched it on Netflix, and it was actually not great quality. I don't know if it was my Wi-Fi, but it was one of the lesser quality streaming experiences I've had on Netflix recently. But the movie was delightful. And it's weirdly like one of the romance movies I've seen between a much older man and a much younger woman that's not uncomfortable. It was only made a few years after North by Northwest, and it's amazing how much older Cary Grant looks, but it's not, it's almost in a charming way. And his interactions with Audrey Hepburn, they're delightful just on a comedy level, but I was sort of very surprised by how sincere it came off and not like awkward or anything like that. So check that film out. It has some twists and turns.
All right. Nick Newman.
I haven't seen anything.
Okay.
So I've just been very busy.
Wait, you actually haven't seen anything?
I have not. No, I resaw like most of Naked Lunch in class.
All right.
I mean, I don't know who else here has seen it, but
I've seen it.
Yeah, it's a very, very good film. But yeah, that's like the only thing, the only cinema I've actually seen any of recently.
Well,
I have to watch a movie for class tonight. So I'll get back on the horse. Memories of Underdevelopment, was actually recently a topic on a film stage contributor Peter Labuza's podcast, The Cinephiliacs. I've heard it's a wonderful movie. I'm looking forward to watching it. So I'll be back with things soon. Just it's been kind of a long week and a half.
So yeah, the surreal, trippy, psychedelic Naked Lunch by David Cronenberg. That's Nick's. I'm going to say that I watched a couple films. I'm going to go with Munich, directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Eric Bana and Daniel Craig and Ciarán Hinds. Great film that really takes you through the toll that the war on terror is kind of taking on everyone on a more personal level. It deals with a group of Israeli special forces people, a crack team assembled to take on the people who orchestrated the attack on the Israeli Olympic team at the Munich Olympics. Really nicely directed. Janusz Kaminski shoots the shit out of that. And it's a tense little morality play, and I quite enjoy it. So check it out. Has anyone else seen Munich?
I actually haven't seen Munich.
Oh, really?
Really?
Yes. And, like, I don't know why, because I feel like I would really like it. It's Kushner, you know? But right. I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's a wonderful movie. It makes a great double feature with his other 2005 film, War of the Worlds.
I saw that a couple weeks ago, too.
Yeah, which is one of that's you know, as far as like, you know, two films released in the same year by the same director go, it doesn't really get much more cynical than that. especially weird because it's Steven Spielberg, but also kind of the, you know, America's foremost director saying some very dark, sobered things about American foreign policy in response to disaster, released within 4 years, in one case, less than 4 years of 9/11. Both are great films. And
I can't stand War of the Worlds.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that movie I think War of the Worlds is like 2/3 of a masterpiece and 1/3 of a relatively good film. But
I guess I can get into that. I hate the kids in that film. Like, to the point where I can't watch it because they're the worst.
But for me,
Dakota Fanning and Justin Chatwin.
For me, it's important that they're kind of insufferable. But whatever.
Why? Anyway, we can talk about that another time. That's it for today. Let's go out on that. And yeah, let's get into where you can find us on the internet. So, Danny King, where can we find you?
Oh, thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
Nick Newman.
Thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and the Little Organ School. Or the Church of the West and the East. Your pick.
One of the two. And you can find me on thefilmstage.com. You can also find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan. And my personal website, dearfilm.net. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. And join us next week when we'll get into the new film, Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson.